and the lossy dielectric would be dissipating RF energy and boiling away that moisture real fast. So people are afraid to use connectors, they're afraid to use adapters. When you're adapting from BNC to type N to UHF and whatever, they think every adapter has got half a dB of loss. Absolutely not. And to try to measure the insertion loss with laboratory test equipment, when the number is so low, it's very difficult. The brute force approach is to put some real RF through it and find out how much heat you get. Calorimetry is the really way to find loss. Now, that was one of the two subjects you discussed a couple of transmissions ago. I forgot what the other one was, Hank. And when YDY, K2RIW.
The other two were feed point height and whether or not an RF ballon or choke would have be helpful. And I think we've answered both of those.
Yeah, your disc cone antenna, to put it up high, I mean, there are three things to make an antenna work well, particularly on VHF frequencies, altitude. And you're going to be mounting it inside the roof of a house. And the insertion loss of the roof is something to consider a little bit. And whether or not on some of those bands it launches current on the outside of the cable, we've already discussed that. But too bad you don't have the ability to put that disc cone on the outside of the roof. Since it's such a small antenna and not very visibly observable, there may be a way you can sneak it on the outside of the roof. Hank, go ahead.
Now there are a bunch of people who live here and are on the board that have nothing better to do than to walk the property and see what violations they can find at residents' addresses. But if I could get anything on the roof, I certainly wouldn't be using a disc cone. But, you know, do the best I can with what I've got. You've seen the house. You know what it is.
And I think you probably got the... But through the top of a closet, you've got access to the crawl space in the roof, and that's what you intend to use, Hank, go ahead.
That's exactly correct.
Okay, good luck with that operation. And does that resident say that people are allowed to use that space for storing things like suitcases or whatever?
Actually, no. Don't tell anybody.
Understand. Okay. Time to go over to Science Talk and mailbag and whatever. AC2GS. Dr. Roy, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Roy.
Dick, could I say something first?
Yeah, go ahead, Rich.
Yes, something you said very often, that the dB gain of antennas is made up in the advertising department. Don't look to pick up an antenna that has the highest gain rate. Some of the companies, what was the old name? The old name was KLM. I forget the new name. They make mighty fine antennas. This was a German company. I don't remember the name. They make HF antennas that are very nice. They're also very stuchy and won't break down. Maybe if the one was sick.
Okay, I missed the words of the last sentence, and I'm not sure if you're asking a question or not. Now back to you, Rich.
Oh, I said there's a German company. They make antennas, the very good antennas, quite a game. And they're very hardly built. They're expensive. They're being now imported by a company called, I forget. But they come out of Germany. And what was the name, the new name, for KLMN's tower? Local 2.
Yeah, I don't think I know the name. Maybe somebody else listening does. Yeah, some of the antennas in the past, Cushcraft, KLM, and others, the 420 and 430 megacycle antennas, some of them had great big gain numbers in the claim. And when they were really measured on an antenna range at the East Coast VHF Society, antenna range measurements that were done every year in the late 60s and 70s, boy, we found some huge differences between what they claim and what they really measured. So that was one of the main places where we came to the conclusion that on many antennas, because people have such a degree of difficulty of confirming, the gain is set in the advertising department, not the measurement laboratory. As such, QST Magazine will not allow any of their antenna advertisements to have a gain claim in the ad, because the results have been so much fibbing in the past that I guess ARL was afraid to put any of those numbers in because you couldn't believe them. Over to you, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. I was wondering if you wanted to give Freddie a try, because he said he was going to stick around.
Oh, Mr. VBN. Let's see if he's there. He almost never is. Go right ahead, Freddie. K2LAW. Yeah, I was afraid of that. There's many past years in which he signs in, and we get to him, he's gone. Over to you, Roy.
Okie doke. Well, I never thought I'd be the perpetual optimist, but someday Freddie will ask his question, I hope. Once again, as always, I like to tell people the email address, although not that many people actually use the email address, but if you have any topics or questions or problems or answers or statements or what have you, the email address to tag base with me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Everything I talk about and a few things that even Paul talks about, I will post things on my linking page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. So right after I'm done with my little stuff, I will post it up there, and there's a nice picture that Paul wanted to share with you. Also, we hang out at the chat room, and there's a lot of different ways of getting there. The easiest that I can think of is just go into your browser and type chat.ac2gs.com, and it'll land you in the chat room. And before I get to the regular science talk, Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, said that he had a physics question and that he had some time limitations. So let's see if Joe wants to ask this question now. Well, so much for my optimism. Maybe he'll come back later. I thought the witching hour was 9:40 to 10:40, and I read 9:11 right here. But anyway, on to the first story and my filler for the night. LEDs, we all love them. Light-emitting diodes are ubiquitous in modern electronic gadgetry, and the three clever fellows that invented the blue LED in the late 1980s and the early 1990s were guys named Tsuji Nakamura, Isamu Akasaki, and Hiroshi Amano. They received the 2014 Nobel Prize for Physics. Using gallium nitride was the key to this invention. Apparently, it was tinkered with since the 1960s, but it was very difficult to grow the P-doped crystals that it required. Professor Akasaki and Amano worked at Nagoya University in Japan and grew the necessary crystals back in 1986 using a very specially designed scaffold made partly of sapphire gemstones. which is very expensive to make and impossible to mass manufacture. 3 years later, Professor Nakamura, while working in Nitsche, used a clever manipulation of temperatures to boost the growth rate of the gallium nitride crystals, making it possible for mass production. The three Nobel Prize winners shared approximately an 8 million kroner prize. That's roughly $861,000 at recent exchange rates. It's been said that Nitsche Corporation earned over 120 billion yen from their blue LED technology alone. That's more than $1 billion in greenbacks. Would anyone like to hazard a guess approximately how big Professor Nakamura's bonus check from Nitsche Corporation was for this incredibly profitable invention? Come on, there must be people who want to play tonight. It made them $1 billion. So if you owned a company and some guy in a lab coat made you $1 billion, what kind of a bonus would you decide to give this poor schlep?
One, why do I? Maybe I'll let the guy retire 5 years early with his pension, but that's about it. I wouldn't give him anything if I was in Japan.
2KNH, zero.
Hey, we have a lot of great entrepreneurs out there. Anyone else?
$5 million, NY2H.
That's very kind of you, Lou. Anyone else with any ideas of what a Japanese company does to thank a loyal employee? Now, you have to understand the context of all this was that very strange. Apparently, Nakamura was kind of told to the whole blue LED thing someplace in the middle, and he pretty much demanded that he be kept on the project, and the project continue to be budgeted. Otherwise, he would quit. And quitting in a Japanese firm is, I think, a very unusual thing. So he was very adamant about it. It wasn't that he was just one of the cogs in the wheel. He was one of the driving forces of this blue LED invention.
2N, maybe he got like 1,000 shares. I don't know what each share would be, but, you know, I'm part of the company.
Probably just fired, but he's too already deep.
Profit sharing is a nice idea. I don't know if it's a Japanese concept. In some places it's an American concept, in the North maybe, in the South not so much. But these are all great ideas. Curious if anyone else has any good ideas.
Can I answer the guess?
No, but I'll answer it right now unless you want to come up with another idea.
$500 or less. Go ahead.
Okay, well, Nitsche actually paid for Schlump a $180 bonus for this billion-dollar invention. Being a sane person, he sued, and the Japanese district court ruled that he should be paid approximately $560 million. But after years in court and mounting lawyers' fees, he finally settled with Nitsche for less than $8 million. And most of that went to pay off his lawyer's bill. So the moral of this particular story is life ain't fair, and send your kids to a good law school. Let's get back to the very beginning of this particular story about light-emitting diodes. Great discoveries seem to be made these days, either in great universities or large companies, and it was just as true for the very first light-emitting diode documented in history. Now, I won't ask you for the discoverer's name, because just like good old Professor Nakamura, few people remember their names. Tonight's question is this. At what well-known company was the idea of a light-emitting diode first documented, and during what decade? So you got a 10-year range. I will caution any players that a cursory Google of this might lead to an incomplete answer. But please, what do you think was the first documented case of an LED? What decade and what major company had bankrolled that discovery?
One YDY, I go for Google in the 1950s. Not Google, I'm sorry, General Electric in the 1950s.
Okay, that's very good answer. Anyone else with any ideas? Okay, someone's trying to answer, but unfortunately you're breaking up. You're about 98% noise, and it doesn't even key up the repeater all the time. So maybe move the antenna around or raise the gain if there's a gain button or anything, and try again. So basically we have one guess of General Electric in 1950. Is there anyone who would like to try, say, a different decade, say, a different company?
N2JKV.
JKV.
Thank you. I'm just going to take a wild guess. I'll say the same decade, I'll say the 50s, and I'll say AT&T.
Okay, very good. Probably if I was guessing the answer, I would have gone to AT&T. Basically, it's Bell Labs. It's the inventor of the transistor back in the 40s, and so it would strike me as the most likely that they would just move on from one discovery to another. Anyone else with any suggestions, any ideas? They can be wacky.
WA2VDH, I'm not sure of the company, but I will definitely say the 50s, late 1950s.
Okay, so people pretty much feel that the 50s were when light-emitting diodes were first discovered and documented. I don't know about you guys. I remember my first light-emitting diode. I actually saw it in a catalog in Radio Shack, and I still remember, unfortunately, having to have a conversation with the guy behind the counter and trying to explain to him what a light-emitting diode was, and I finally had to ask him for the catalog and show him the entry, and we both discovered where it was hidden in the corner of the back of the Radio Shack. But, Radio Shack is, it's bankrupt, but it's coming back in some weird shape. But that's my story for LEDs, but I the story, that happened in the 70s for me. So if they discovered them in the 50s, that means there was a heck of a lag time for Radio Shack to start selling them. Else want to offer any kind of different opinion, a different company, a different era? Anyone think that it could have been discovered earlier in the 20th century than 1950? You're actually warmer than the other answers. So think a long, long time ago. Think a historical but not terribly important this week company.
To you, 1961.
Okay, my guess is you Googled it, did you?
Essentially, yes.
Okay, well, that's allowed, although I did caution people that if you Googled it, chances are you might come up with an incomplete answer. Not a particularly wrong answer, but an incomplete one. So one more time, I'll just kind of leave it out to the rest of the people. If you have any kind of suggestions, please feel free. We don't take points off. I like innovative and creative answers. What decade, what big company? You don't even have to know the inventor because no one knows the inventors, unfortunately.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I seem to remember a story with the transistor radio. They had transistor radios and they realized if they had the cover off, it would affect the transistors. You know, the light would change things. So then they said, well, that means if we energize the transistors without any kind of a cover, we might get a light out of it. So I'm going to go with the late 1950s because of the transistor radio.
Okay, Paul, again, very logical, very rash. The way that that semiconductors work, and diodes is a semiconductor, is they have a P-junction and an N-junction, and when electrons travel between from the N-junction to the P-junction, you get that voltage drop that we're all aware of. Germanium has a smaller voltage drop than silicon, and when those electrons drop the voltage potential, effectively it's going somewhere. For the most part, we kind of think of it as just heat, but in many cases, it's actually a part of the electromagnetic spectrum. A photon is created. If it's enclosed in non-transparent medium, it quickly gets absorbed and regenerated as heat. But diodes do emit light of differing frequencies. The trick is to find the right crystal that has the right band gap energy that's in the visible light spectrum. Anyone else with any ideas on this subject before I let loose with the strange and bizarre answer?
One YDY, are you trying to get us to go down the path that it was actually crystal radio, so it was done in the 20s or 30s?
Yes, I am indeed. Given that hint, that's a big hint. So what was a big company in the early 20th century?
WB2GXM.
Yes, WB2GXM. You were going to say something.
Hello, Roy. HC2GS, WB2GXM, Rich. I may be off base, but there go my cards again. I would say Westinghouse.
That would be a very good guess. It's not the right guess, but it's a very good guess. One more time, I'll ask anyone if they have any kind of idea. Again, it's a very famous, at least I think of it as a very famous company that's probably was bought up by one of these other guys and now goes by one of the names that we're more familiar with in the 21st century. But back in the turn of the 20th century, I think it was somewhat famous, especially for amateur radio operators.
Yeah, XM again.
Rich.
Well, how about Edison? Owned by Edison.
Okay, again, a very good guess. The wrong guess, but a very good guess. So you need to triangulate a little bit somewhere in between. So if you had to kind of put Edison and Company on one side and Westinghouse on the other side, and it's, say, 1907... what company would hams kind of know and love today from 1907?
Yep, and one YDY?
Yes, Hank.
Thanks,
said the Zenith Radio Corporation? Long gone.
No, it wasn't Zenith. I don't know for sure. I would assume Zenith was a brand, say, in the 1930s or so. Not that I've looked it up. But it doesn't strike me as a turn-of-the-century brand name, but I might be wrong.
How about Marconi, WSN? I mean, you're going way back. Marconi had a company.
Paul Astar, in 1907, a gentleman by the name of H.J. Round was working for the Marconi lab. He was using a cat's whisker detector, which is better known as a silicon carbide crystal. They probed it with a wire to find a point where it would act as a diode rectifying detector for RF waves. Now, he noticed that part of the crystals tended to light up a pale yellow when you put a 10-fold potential across the cat's whisker detector crystal. Now, you can actually do this for yourself if you're so inclined, or if you want to, I will leave a link on my link page on roy.ac2.com for a guy who does the exact experiment on YouTube, and you can see the light flashing. Let me drop for a sec. Okay. Now, this odd behavior was duly written. I think it was worth a couple of paragraphs in some document someplace that was published, but pretty much nothing was done about it at the time. And 15 years later, in the USSR, a self-taught scientist by the name of Oleg Vladimirovich Losev noticed the same exact phenomena, but rather than just writing two paragraphs about it, he wrote reams of stuff on it. He wrote a lot of research papers, and unfortunately, just as well, they didn't go anywhere. No one seemed to care about them, and they just collected dust. Now, it wasn't until 1962. Some people did guess 62, although some people guessed in the 50s. But it was not until 1962 that a visible light-emitting diode was created by a gentleman called Nick Holonyak while working at General Electric. He's generally known as the father of the LED. Now, that's not to say that noticed or cared about solid-state diodes that seem to emit electromagnetic waves at their p-n junction. It was just that using normal germanium and silicon-doped crystals, the light, if you call it light, was invisible. It was the far infrared. There was a guy, Reuben Bronstein at RCA, who reported in 1955 that some simple diodes emitted infrared light when connected to current. There were guys called Gary Pittman and Bob Beard from Texas Instruments. They reported that gallium arsenide diodes emitted infrared light with current. But it wasn't until Nick Holonyak tried his hand that LEDs produced full visible light. Now, Nick Holonyak got this title, but he never did get his Nobel Prize, unlike the guys who did the blue LED. So, as I said before, as I'll say again, life ain't fair, and send your kid to a good law school.
This repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Anyway, that was the spiel on LEDs. If anyone has any comments, questions, or answers, feel free. Look on to the next story. Pi Day came and Pi Day went left, but unfortunately I didn't mention it here at the science talk. Paul did, but I did not. Google had something big to celebrate for Pi Day this year. One of its teams had broken the Guinness World Book of Records for the most accurate value of pi. A lady called Emma Haruka Ayoa and her colleagues used the power of cloud computing to calculate pi to 31,415,926,535,897 digits. That's 9 trillion digits more than the previous record and a whole novel longer than the 3.14 value most of us know and love. To accomplish the task, Iowa had to run a Pi benchmark application called YCruncher on 25 Google Cloud virtual machines for 121 days. Now, according to Google, the problem with computing for such a large number is that the time and resources needed for the task increases more rapidly than the number itself. Iowa said the biggest challenge was that the project required a lot of storage and memory to calculate. It needed a whopping 170 terabytes. That's equivalent to all the indexed searchable parts of the Internet back in 2002 to be completed. In addition, the longer the supercomputer works on computation, the higher risk of hardware outage that can impact the process. Let me drop for a second. Running the computation in the cloud prevented these issues from arising and made access to 170 terabytes possible, since Google just had to keep its cloud infrastructure running. Also, it allows the tech giant to sell researchers access to the digit for over 40 bucks a day without having to save the massive data set in a physical drive. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, very well. Have you been considering a little winter getaway where the winter weather is more agreeable than here on Long Island? Well, have you considered Klaywak, Alaska? Apparently, Alaska is where it's at. A bizarre March warmth has engulfed the frontier state, setting an all-time temperature record in the latest manifestation of a new climate ripping the Arctic. On last Tuesday, Klaywak, Alaska topped out at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. That makes the earliest 70-degree Fahrenheit day ever reported in Alaska. The previous record was set just 3 years ago when Klaywak reached 71 degrees Fahrenheit on March 31st. In comparison, many cities in the Northeast have yet to crack that mark. Now, Klaywak is pretty far south in Alaska, sitting about equidistant between Anchorage and Seattle. But the rest of the state, while not quite as sizzling, has been in the grips of a serious warm wave. In addition to Klaywak, at least five other locations set monthly high temperature records, according to an analysis by Alaska weather watcher Rick Salmon. Let me drop for a second. The heat didn't stop at the border either. Record-setting warmth spread over western Canada and the Pacific Northwest as monthly records fell across British Columbia, Alberta, the Northwest Territories, and the Yukon. And not to be outdone, by the 70s in Alaska, temperatures topped 81 degrees Fahrenheit in places in Washington's Olympic Peninsula and 79 degrees Fahrenheit in Seattle. Both are an all-time March record. The spurts of warm weather has been ushered in by what meteorologists call an omega blast. It happens when an area of high pressure camps out over a location, forcing the fast-flowing river of air that is the jet stream to go around it. On a weather map, it looks like a fancy horseshoe, or if you're a Greekophile, the letter for omega. No matter how you describe it, the pattern keeps warm air locked in over the location under high pressure and is a classic setup for breaking heat records. Heat is forecast to keep that region roasting into the week, so it's possible more records could fall. Let me drop for a second. If this was an isolated incident, it wouldn't be a big deal, but no weather happens in a vacuum anymore, especially in the rapidly changing Arctic. Alaska just had its third warmest winter on record, according to data kept by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The heat extended to the Bering Sea, which saw its second lowest concentration of sea ice in February, trailing only last year when ice all but disappeared. The Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet and hasn't been this hot in a millennia, they say. This week's heat wave was symptomatic of a much larger shift afoot, driven by factors that are contentious between politicians, if not scientists. And it's far from the worst impact that we could see in the coming years. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
You know, that could cause a problem for the pipeline, the Alaskan pipeline. That thing runs like 800 miles from, you know, from the northern Prideaux Bay all the way down, and, you know, to the to the ocean, you know, the Bering Strait, where you know, the oil comes from the fields, and they eventually go to the big tankers over there, 800 miles, and they have all that pipe suspended on stanchions, you know, these gigantic stanchions, roughly a four-foot diameter pipe. And then these stanchions, they actually have them with refrigeration hookups to try to keep the ground below them frozen, you know. So, I mean, you know, it was good up to a certain point. You know, they call it the frozen tundra. But if it gets any warmer than that, that might not be able to keep up. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, Paul, as the old Chinese curse goes, we're living in interesting times. Weather patterns do change. They're changeable. They're erratic. They're very difficult to predict. And is this all humanity's fault? Is this 0.7% humanity's fault? Well, I can't tell you, although scientists have a keen idea of what percentage it might be. But I think the common interest would be to try and figure out if we can do anything about it. We may not be able to, but if we don't try, we definitely won't be able to.
Yeah, okay, very good. I haven't heard that report about Alaska until now.
I'm glad I'm not giving you old news here. I try to be current. One of the things that amuses me endlessly is when I tune into a YouTube video a week after I do it on the Science Talk and they're doing the same subject. So I know I picked the right item. On to the next. Medicine can be like witnessing a tennis match. The ball goes to the right, then to the left, then to the right again. Now, lay people can see this almost weekly, alternating clickbait ads suggesting that coffee is worse than poison or the elixir of youth. But tonight's story is about the changing belief for the common baby aspirin. Due to Reye's syndrome, which can afflict childhood viral infections, when they're treated with aspirin, it's been relabeled as low-dose aspirin. You know it, you love it, your doctor probably told you to take it. Well, cardiologists delivered some surprising news over the past weekend, contrary to previous recommendations. Most healthy people, they say, should not be taking low-dose aspirin to prevent heart disease. That's according to a report from the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association. The report offers the usual advice for those ward off heart disease, the balanced diets of mostly plants, exercise, don't smoke, etc. But the new recommendation against daily aspirin follows a 2018 study that found aspirin's benefits did not seem to outweigh their risks. Let me drop for a second. The 2018 Esprit study recruited almost 20,000 people, mostly over the age of 70 in the United States and Australia, hoping to study the effects of long-term low-dose aspirin use. Previously, doctors had recommended a daily dose of 75 to 100 milligrams to avert a heart problem, but the research found that people taking low-dose aspirin were just as likely to die over the course of the study period than those taking a placebo. The research also found that those taking aspirin were a bit more likely to have major bleeding episodes as well. This study doesn't show whether or not aspirin prevents heart disease. Rather, it shows that its risks might cancel out its benefits. The College of Cardiology recommends for now that doctors only recommend aspirin to those who are at high risk for cardiovascular disease and the lowest risk of bleeding, according to a statement. For everyone else, doctors should continue to recommend the stuff patients really don't want to hear. Don't smoke, eat more vegetables, and eat less processed foods, and exercise regularly. Let me drop for a sec. Health recommendations are ultimately based on the most knowledge available, which means that new long-term study results might overturn these recommendations. How eating lots of eggs were bad, then they were fine, then they were bad again. Now, there's only one thing for certain. Death comes to us all. Yes. On that happy note, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
Taking half the adult amount. No, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I've been taking one half of a 250, so that's a 1 1/4 every day. What is, with this report, what is a person to do? I had a heart attack in 2006. I now have two additional stents in me, but no other episodes, angina or anything like that, you know. So what are we to do?
Well, my first answer to almost any question is follow the advice of the physician that you go to, who examines you and knows you and you trust. As a secondary answer, you suggest that you are high risk for atherosclerotic heart disease, having had it in the past and having stents for it. So that would put you in a different category than the study, which suggests that people in their 60s who do not have any cardiovascular risk or have rather severe risks of GI bleeding, probably aspirin wouldn't be a good idea.
Stated, I should have asked, what is my cardiologist to do?
I would assume, once again, that your cardiologist should read the papers, understand the underlying concepts, and hopefully come to the same conclusion that other people in his field have come to, and go down the same line. This is not a legal requirement, unless, of course, you end up getting sued, in which if a lawyer who, as I suggested in a previous story, send your kid to a good law school, get you on the in court and ask you why you didn't follow the guidelines of the American College of Cardiologists, and you said, I just felt like not doing that. So chances are he will toe the line with everyone else until the next study indicates that that's the wrong line to toe.
You take your chances, either way.
Always take your chances, Rich. You try and make your chances a little bit better if you can, but ultimately, life's just a crapshoot.
So, because, you know, every other year, something flip-flops, vitamin E, vitamin C, simvastatins, you know, statins flip-flop. Everything seems to flip-flop constantly.
I mean, you could look at the half glass full or half empty or poison. Science and medical science is science, is autocorrecting. A lot of studies are not terribly good studies. A lot of studies are poorly designed, and the probabilities aren't figured very well, and so you get a new study with a lot more samples that disagrees with the previous one that has less samples, and you just play cat and mouse with it. But I would rather have a self-correcting, rational system than something that's locked down, that someone came off of a mountaintop saying that statins are definitely good for you and a baby aspirin is definitely good for you, and, eggs are definitely bad for you. So that's something that we have to deal with. Doctors don't enjoy it either. We tend to like to seem somewhat vaguely godlike. And when we change our minds based on the research, we're less omniscient than people want us to be.
I guess. Thanks for the answer. Thanks for those answers, Roy. But it's tough. It's got to be, like you just said, which I never really thought of that much. It's got to be tough on the physicians, too, if these studies reverse themselves every 2 years.
I mean, technology in general, and Dick can speak for electrical engineers, is a moving target. If you rest on your laurels, if you got really good grades in graduate school and you stop learning at that point, you'd be a lazy person, whatever profession you would pick. It's a moving target, and you got to be ready to move. And a lot of things have changed in the, 40 years that I've been involved in medicine, and they'll continue to change. It's the nature of science and technology. Nothing's perfect. Nothing comes out the first way perfect. Okay, on to the next story. Well, I guess that the moral for the following story is when you're buying a commercial jet, pay for all the extras. Well, at least that's the conclusion that some experts were coming to as investigations continue into what caused those two plane crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia in the past 5 months. Both flights were the new Boeing 737 MAX 8 model planes, and both aircraft lacked safety features that are extra by Boeing, like a special light that notifies pilots when the software on the plane may be getting a false reading. You could see where this might be a very useful item. The New York Times has a new report this past week quoting experts about safety feature and notes that the Federal Aviation Administration doesn't require the features to be deemed airworthy. They're critical and cost almost nothing for the airlines to install, an analyst with the aviation firm Liam told the Times. Boeing charges for them because it can, but they're vital for safety. The two safety features at issue are the angle of attack sensor and the green light. Let me drop for a second. Ethiopian Airline Flight 302 crashed and killed 157 people shortly after takeoff on March 10th, while Lion Air Flight 610 crashed off the coast of Indonesia on October 29th, 2018, and killed all 189 on board. The assumed similarity of the crashes were based on ongoing analysis by investigators, caused countries to ground the 737 MAX all around the world. Boeing has promised that it's working on the problem, which investigators believe may be the result of malfunctioning software and a failure to properly train pilots on the plane system. Software on the Boeing 737 MAX measures the angle of the plane and automatically tries to correct the error when it believes that the nose is too high, which might cause the plane to stall. The system, called the Maneuvering Characteristic Augmentation System, MCAS, which was discussed here last week by Hank, may have gotten a false reading in both crashes, but without the optional disagree light to indicate that different sensors may be picking up different readings, the pilot might not have known what was going on. Let me drop for a sec. In a statement earlier this month, Boeing acknowledged that it had made updates to the MCAS in its new planes, but that it was to make an already safe aircraft even safer. Aviation-focused news website, The Air Current, was perhaps the first to point out back in March 12th, just 2 days after the crash in Ethiopia, on the morning of the March 10th, that the safety features were part of an optional package on the doomed flight. A warning light that would have alerted the crew to the disagreement wasn't part of the added cost optional package of the equipment on Lion Air 737 MAX aircraft. A guardrail wasn't in place. Once the aircraft was airborne, the erroneous angle of attack data collided with an apparently unprepared crew with tragic consequences as the MCAS system repeatedly activated, driving the jet's nose into a fatal dive. The exact price of the safety feature is unknown at this time, but what is known is that Boeing makes a pretty penny from these add-ons, potentially accounting for about 5% of the final price of the aircraft. Based on data extrapolated from a 2013 report by consulting firm Jackson Square Aviation. What's also known is that the lower-cost airlines like Ethiopian and Indonesian Lion Air may be less likely to purchase the add-ons. U.S.-based carriers like Southwest and American purchase the particular safety upgrades that issue for the 737 MAX planes, according to the Times. United Airlines apparently did not. Let me drop for a second. Whoever's fault it may ultimately be determined, Boeing is saying by way of its sinking stock market prices, it's canceled orders. Garuda Indonesia has told Boeing that it wants to cancel its $4.9 billion order for 49 Boeing 737 MAX 8. They had ordered 50 airplanes back in 2014, but they only received one in 2017, although it looks like the back order problem is the least of Boeing's problems. Now, something tells me this won't be the only canceled order that Boeing will have to deal with. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
All right, N1YDY. When you're done, may I please have it before it goes out for general questions?
Yes, certainly, Hank. I would love your informed opinion about all this. Yeah, Hank, feel free. You have the floor.
Okay. I've read the article in the New York Times and a few other things that I've sought out myself, as well as some in-house publications that are produced for two different airlines and friends of mine who are still employed have sent me. All I want to say is that what you said is overly simplistic and doesn't really address the issues. These are not truly safety features. These are features that could be analogous to, say, an alternator fail light in your car if you already have both an ammeter and a voltmeter in the car from the factory. So if you have these two gauges, you should be expected to know what the readings mean, rather than have to have a specialty idiot light that just says, hey, look here. So it's much more complex. And Boeing does charge more for these features, but this isn't pure profit. It's not like putting a light bulb in and saying, okay, this is a $50,000 light bulb. There are so many items that are involved with this additional feature, not just the feature itself, but the additional weight, anything that's on the airplane that's part of the airplane is a pound of weight that you can't use and sell as a passenger seat. So you want an airplane, if you're the operator, that weighs the least while still being safe, because the more the basic operating weight, which is what the airplane weighs with oil and seats and all sorts of everything except for fuel and payload, passengers and baggage. So all these things, you know.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
2 Bravo Zulu.
Did somebody tell me where I talked too long and the timeout started?
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu with a question.
Yes, Rich recognized. We'll get to you, Rich. I'm sorry, I didn't write down. It was about 3 minutes ago.
I missed the dot. All I'm trying to say is that it's much more complex than the airline didn't, because they were a low-cost airline or a foreign airline, that they just didn't buy the additional safety feature. Of course, more safety is better than less, but the more features you have, the more systems are in the airplane to cause those features to work. Those systems have weight, they have complexity, they have cost. All those things work against the operator trying to operate the aircraft as best they can. If there are any questions, and I believe it was Bravo Zulu, Rich, if you guys don't have any questions, we'll pick him up first.
Yeah, I just want to point out, yes, it's a simplification and life is complicated, and this problem is a very complicated one that's going to end up litigated for many years to come, unfortunately, and there'll be lots of paperwork explaining both ends, and hopefully people will come to some better fact-filled conclusion. But Rich wanted to ask a question. So W2BZ Rich, ask your question.
Okay, I guess I just doubled. I saw a television report where there are two sensors. This is an optional system, one on the right, one on the left. And if they don't agree with each other, a light goes on in the cockpit. Could one of these optional features been as simple as that?
Yes and no. The yes, because the light would certainly have drawn somebody's attention. The no, because it's really not an optional feature to have. The gauges that were failing, the angle of attack vanes, they're used by other systems in the aircraft, the air data computer being the primary one. So they're physically there, no matter which version of the airplane that you purchase. Both of these vanes are there. Maybe there could have been a light that, you know, looked at a discontinuity or a discrepancy between the two of them. But the bottom line is that if I can give you an example, if you are driving a car that has an alternator and that alternator has both an ammeter and a voltmeter, do you really need to have an idiot light that comes on that says battery or whatever, like most cars have? They already had all the information they needed.
And my second question, my second question is, the engineers that design these systems and then the marketing guys, when they got together, how could they have decided to make what turned out to be the cause of so many deaths, make it be an optional feature? How could they decide, conclude, and you're talking high-level engineers now, how could they decide to make these optional features?
Well, I believe I've already addressed that. If you already have somebody who should know how the vehicle or the aircraft operates, and you give him the type of gauges that give him very specific information, he doesn't recognize this, is he really benefited by having an additional light? And unfortunately, I think the answer will turn out to be yes, but that's a dumbing down of not just society, but of what had been a professional activity in society at one time. When I was younger, if you couldn't fix it, they didn't want you to fly it. And I don't mean it physically fix it in terms of take every part apart, but you needed to be able to describe how the systems work, talk about what their requirements were, and how to repair them in the event of a failure. So I don't really believe it's the engineer's fault. I believe it's the fault of the marketing company or the marketing department, especially when you look at something that someone that says, gee, we have this airplane already certified. We want to get it into the hands of customers. So if we tell the government that you don't need to recertify certain things because they're so similar to what's already been put out into the real world, then you end up with people flying an airplane that don't get additional training for it, and if these people that don't get additional training for it don't get it, and we discover that they're under-trained to begin with, they can make errors. They did both make errors that were deadly.
QIS query.
Going to be no longer optional?
C2IS query.
Before I get to AIS, can I ask, who was the first guy who had the additional thing about optional?
Rich, W2BZ, if these are going to, in fact, no longer be optional, but be required, then the answer to the question is someone in the marketing department or someone in the engineering department made a hell of a fatal mistake by making them optional.
There's an element of truth in what you're saying, but the real issue is why didn't the flight crew recognize it? When the airplane was made, Boeing has, this is where there might be some level of error that is beyond complacency. When the aircraft was made, Boeing wanted to be able to say, if you have a pilot whose license says type Boeing 737, he can jump from one to another without any specialized training. Airbus does is with their aircraft. I have an Airbus A320 type. It's good for the 318, the 319, the 320, the 321, the 320neo, all these aircraft. Boeing also did it with the 757 and the 767. Your license to fly one allowed you to fly another. Unfortunately, this change that has been made for the 737